Hey, Adam.
And hello, everyone. Welcome back to, is it season two?
Season two.
Of Liver Talks.
Some people said we'd never get to episode two, but most people said we wouldn't get to season two. So we decided to move up season two.
Yeah, right. Season two is really kind of more whatever we make it. So we could have had season two after the first episode.
Well, we didn't. We're having it now, and welcome. Thank you all for listening.
Yes, thank you so much. Thanks for being patient as we took like a 2 month sabbatical for the holidays and whatnot, but we're back.
Mm-hmm. Just like the US. I think our meta focus this year is going to be on disparities in liver disease, whether that be health disparities related to race, which is going to be a particular focus of ours, but also other disparities, including based on gender, based on rural-urban divide. And so while our goal is to bring you a broad spectrum of different topics within hepatology, with each of our guests, we're going to try to push to identify and think about solutions to the disparities that exist within that specific niche of the field of hepatology that we're talking about.
Yeah, absolutely. And also important to note that the lightning round questions have basically remained the same.
Those, yes, that's exactly right.
The one constant between series. So today we're going to be talking about hepatitis C.
Yeah.
Isn't that right?
Yeah.
Yeah. I think one of the reasons or the impetus for us choosing this topic, hepatitis C, is because it's a really interesting example of how science evolves from kind of like trial science and, you know, doing clinical trials for curative treatments for hep C and sort of transitions into the public health realm and the messiness of that transition and how there are goals for, you know, universal cure and how there are pitfalls inherent to that. And so I think our guest, Dr. Puni Purumaswamy from the University of Michigan, who's going to talk to us a little bit about the challenges that we face in achieving universal treatment for hepatitis C.
Yeah, I think it's a very interesting idea because it's more in the realm of implementation research instead of where much of the funding goes, which is sort of new discoveries and rolling things out and proof of concept, et cetera. But we have the rare case where a cure has been found, and yet we're not doing a great job in curing people. And so trying to think about the hurdles in going from having a cure to actually getting rid of an epidemic that's growing currently is pretty interesting. I think everybody will find this conversation very, very interesting.
Yeah, I hope so. So after the break, we'll come back and we'll talk to our guests. Our first guest of 2021, in honor, is Dr. Puni Purumaswamy, an associate professor and hepatologist at the University of Michigan. Part of her experience is in linkage of at-risk patient populations to HCV care, so we're glad she agreed to come on to talk about her experience and the challenges in the treatment of hepatitis C.
Thanks for having me. Really excited.
So the WHO, which we are once again members of, in 2016 proposed a goal of eliminating HCV, which they labeled as a public health threat, by 2030. Thus far, it seems like around three states are potentially on track to reach that goal. And in thinking about the challenges, it seems like there's sort of three buckets. One is diagnosis, one is linkage or access to care, and then the third is actually treating them with direct-acting antiretrovirals. In sort of looking at this goal and the future of HCV care, where do you sort of see the majority of the barriers lying for the U.S.?
So that's a great question. I'm actually surprised to hear it. Three states are headed towards elimination. I know there are some countries that have made some tremendous progress. And, you know, I think we'll start with like this issue of like, why are we even talking about elimination? And certainly, I think it all has to do with we finally have the right tools, right, in our toolbox. And I think that there still are barriers to treatment. I think from the hepatologist's perspective, certainly what I've been hearing from colleagues in the field is that there's this feeling that we have done a tremendous job with, you know, getting patients into trials that led to the approval of the direct acting antivirals. And in large part, a lot of our specialty practices have done, made a lot of strides with treating a lot of patients who we were managing with Hep C. But I think where there seems to still be a disconnect is that there are still a lot of new cases of Hep C that are happening. These new cases are kind of in the shadow of the opioid epidemic, I think is kind of one way the CDC and others have, you know, phrased what's going on, that there are these syndemics. And so, you know, certainly one key barrier to elimination has to do with cost. I think that's like a central issue we seem to still try to dance around to some extent. And also this concept of how do we reach patients that are not coming to our brick and mortar practices, understanding why they're not coming to our brick and mortar practices. And I think it kind of goes back into like there has been this great evolution of barriers to care. I think there's still a ways to go such that we're going to actually be able to say people who are living with Hep C can really easily access treatment in the United States. And I think just because they're not coming to our specialty practices doesn't mean that this is all resolved and taken care of. So I do think rethinking what our strategy should be and what optimal models of care is really important, because if these patients aren't coming to our practices as specialists, and given where treatments have evolved to, that they are much simpler, less side effects, minimal side effects, very high cure rates, how do we build the bridge between expanding provider capacity and not to take on an overly brotherly, big brotherly role, I would say, in our role as specialists, but to just facilitate in the areas that we can advocate for as specialists. And I still think there's a lot of work in that area for us to be doing. And also thinking about how can we more easily help, like be helping providers at large build a bridge so that they feel comfortable to take on treatment.
Do you think that who do you think the key shareholders are in terms of, you know, trying to promote that? Is it mostly hepatology, infectious disease? Do you think there's like one, is it siloed? Is someone like kind of taking the lead on that, or is it more like a collaborative effort in your experience?
Well, so I think what we're seeing is that payers have created a lot of barriers. And again, this still comes down to cost of treatment, which is quite high. And so what you've seen is that a lot of particularly Medicaid insurance payers, and this varies state by state, have implemented various restrictions around who they will approve treatment for. So we have these lengthy approval kind of processes. We have then all of these barriers somewhat artificially, you know, in place. And I don't think this is helping moving treatment out into the spaces where it's going to reach the people who are living with Hep C. And I think this is where if we look to other countries where I know we're not going to be able to emulate, you know, nationalized healthcare plans and other kind of, you know, health systems. But I think there are things that we can learn. And we have seen some successful models of how we can build bridges. And I would just say that, like, we need to move away still from, again, taking these new models, if it's an echo-like model, and not creating it, again, a barrier, but more of a bridge so that providers who are interested can utilize it, but not making them have to use it in order, you know, like in, for example, and similar to where New York used to be, you have to be prescribing in consultation with a specialist.
So a PCP can't just write the script for...
No, and New York was in the same place several years ago. And they now over time, I think New York has been a leader. California has been a leader in these areas to move away from restrictions. But, you know, in New York, we also had the restriction of you needed to have like 10 CME credits associated with Hep C and or case consultations with specialty providers that when DEAs were first approved. And not really based in anything. And it's not really, I think, helping to overcome barriers to get providers on, you know, interested and feeling like it can be done with ease and expertise on their own.
You mentioned Project Echo, and you know a lot of that is kind of deputizing primary care to kind of pick up the burden of screening and then also treating, and hopefully in areas where they're able to prescribe. But then there's also a large population that kind of lives on the quote unquote margins, you know, the homeless, prison population, and you kind of alluded to it, the uninsured who kind of get lost in these kinds of interventions like Project Echo. They might not have access to primary care. I don't know in your experience if there's one group or population that's the most challenging to identify and treat, or is it kind of like all these, you know, or is it all of them?
Yeah, so I think this is why some people have focused on like thinking about this as kind of like a micro elimination approach, because probably it's not going to be like necessarily one size fits everybody. Because as you say, you know, incarcerated persons have a different connection to healthcare, right? And versus like somebody living in a rural community that might be living with Hep C, where they have a family physician or a primary care physician, mm-hmm. and they have no access to specialists. So I think we have to take like what things we can learn from these models and try to adapt them to the best that we can. I do think like to date, like we've created so many webinars around Hep C. Webinars are great, but probably if I just watched a Hep C webinar, I'm not sure how motivated I would be to say, yes, now I'm going to go out and fill out a prior authorization form and
let's go.
Be able to do that on my own. So I think the ECHO model really was like walking providers through cases. And I don't know, I was thinking about this a little ahead of this podcast. I think for a good reason, we've moved away from this whole concept that we learned, I think, in medical mm-hmm. school training around like, see one, do one, teach one. In some ways, I'm not trying to oversimplify what needs to be done here, but I think, again, in thinking of this as a concept of a bridge, like how can we help build capacity in these providers and often walking through a case or two and understanding, you know, what things need to be done, like a fibrosis assessment, checking for drug-drug interactions, how to walk through a prior authorization form, because that still is our reality, are helpful things for a lot of providers. I think there are some providers who can watch a webinar and mm-hmm. will feel motivated to go out and do that. So Adam, you know, you just talked about like deputizing other providers to be involved in this process and take this on. So in a lot of other countries, and even with other diseases, we've shown that this can be done, this whole concept of task shifting, right? That even between providers, types of healthcare workers, involvement of other key people in the model of care, if they're navigators or care coordinators. And in other countries that have been very successful and are on track for what looks like Hep C elimination, there has been some task shifting. And so I think, yes, in some ways we have taken on this deputizing approach, whereas I think the spirit of a tax shifting approach would be more giving people supportive resources and funding and eliminating some of the other barriers and building this bridge. Right now, it seems to be very focused on trying to identify Hep C champions in terms of providers in that are not necessarily specialists. They might be addiction specialists or primary care specialists. And that works some of the time. I think it's pretty labor intense to be like going and seeking out providers who want to come on board. Here in Michigan, it's been interesting. I've started working with these rural providers, and one is a family physician, another is a family physician who's also doing addiction treatment, and two other are working in medication-assisted therapy programs. And they work in rural parts of the state where there's no access to mm-hmm. specialists easily. Traveling distance is an issue for obvious reasons. And so they've reached out saying, hey, we want to try to connect, to learn. Can you walk us through cases? So we've started like a case conferencing session every 2 weeks based mm-hmm. on the feedback that they gave us. And some of them have just felt comfortable after a few sessions to start doing more of them or just emailing to discuss the cases, because cool. Michigan does have the Medicaid restriction where you have to put a specialist provider on the prior auth. So I think hopefully those restrictions will go away state by state. It's just too bad we have to like do this state by state rather than having kind of some national priority around it.
I think, you know, tying into this, it seems like the resources that would be required would require funding. And I was, you know, there's a great figure in a paper that you were a co-author on, and I think Hepatology Communications from this year, Innovations in Hep C Screening and Treatment. And it compares the overall burden of Hep C and HIV, I think, in a really stark way, you know, basically showing side by side that, you know, hepatitis C has a higher prevalence, is more fatal than HIV now, and yet receives a fraction of the federal funding. You know, you really have to zoom in on the bar graph to even see, to identify the amount of funding that Hep C is getting. You know, do you think that that's like an awareness issue, a lobbying issue, like a historical issue? In order to kind of do some of the things that we want to do, I assume it's going to take some more federal interest in doing so, I think.
I don't know the answer to that. I will tell you what the inspiration for that bar graph was. That I kind of was inspired by a bar graph I saw more than 10 years ago in a paper that Brian Edlin wrote. I think it was like in Nature Reviews or another journal. And I had actually used it in some talks that I had given over the years for Hep C. And so that was pre-DAAs. And I was like, what if I just like look at these numbers again that were recently published and try to recreate these graphs, and they look exactly the same. Like nothing's changed in more than 10 years, mm-hmm. even with the implementation of DAAs in terms of federal funding for clinical services and research and additional funding. This is not to say that CDC has like invested additional dollars over time. When you look at the funding, the federal funding over the last 3 years, it's been flat. This gets to part of the issue of like where some of the problem and challenges still lie. I don't know what the fix for it is, though, which I think is the second part of asking. I don't know what the answer is, because I feel like a lot of lobbying has been done. I think there are a lot of advocates and that are still pounding the table saying we need more, we need more. I don't know if it's going to be a matter of we get to like a critical point for whatever reason. Maybe we will get there soon. That would be my hope. I think a lot of it has to be, I think there could be a lot of great things that could be done at federal like level. Removing barriers, trying to streamline novel diagnostics to make this like one-step process, eliminate prior authorizations, have people go the same day to pick up their scripts at the pharmacy. Like that would be like, I think, the ideal model, and it's being done in other parts of the world. So I don't know. I want to stay inspired that more progress can be made. I'm not sure I have the answer as to how it will be done.
Yeah.
And if there was suddenly an influx of money or funding, and you've listed a number of things that probably would make a difference, is there sort of a number one thing that you think would be the most bang for your buck?
I definitely think if there's any way to negotiate for lower prices or generics, like that will really change the whole game here. I think the second part will be if all the state Medicaid programs can eliminate all of their restrictions. I mean, we still have states that have sobriety restrictions. We now have worldwide models in different settings where we know in supportive settings, we can do treatment successfully with very low rates of reinfection, even with ongoing substance use. You know, one project my colleague Jeff Weiss is involved with, and I'm still kind of remotely involved with, is like doing Hep C treatment at a syringe exchange program, bringing telemedicine to methadone programs, another project that Andy Talal is kind of spearheading in New York. So I do think that there are interesting things where we can like try to implement models. And I do think there needs to be some funding, because a lot of them rely on another person to assist the existing healthcare provider, again, serving a bridge, because there are still so many pieces to overcome. If it's telemedicine visits, this is not a patient population that may be comfortable with doing that or have the resources to do that. If it's, you know, care coordinators working with patients to engage them because it's too time intensive for a provider, a physician or a nurse or an NP or PA to be doing that. But these things are not reimbursable at the moment. So, you know, one thing through our CMS funded program Project Inspire was that we attempted to try to make it a reimbursable model. So at the end of this these CMS funded grants. They give you an opportunity to take it to the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid to make an argument for why you would want to make this a reimbursable model. And we did that twice, actually, unsuccessfully, I think in large part because the committee really viewed that there were already pathways to have these things reimbursed, when in reality, like, what practice do you know has a care coordinator that can be, you know, reimbursed for services they're providing for Hep C patients? So the system can be more streamlined and less complicated, and I think that would really, really help overcome some of these challenges. But removing all the statewide restrictions, because there isn't really a basis for any of that, I think is key, and lowering the drug prices. And I think those two things kind of are going hand in hand.
And lowering, I mean, the VA has been able to do that, to lower drug prices. So it seems like, you know, there's some precedent there.
It's possible.
Yeah, you know, the VA is a successful model, I think, in this area, but it wasn't without some early missteps. You know, I think some of the barriers to care in the VA system very early when DAAs were approved included, like, needed service connectedness to the Hep C diagnosis in order to get treatment approved. Before they negotiated for the lower prices, the pricing was a big issue. They also had, I think, some sobriety restrictions also in place. And then in 2015, U.S. Congress appropriated like $3 billion to just focus in the VA system around Hep C. And so what it led to was all of these resources, like centralized leadership, and different VAs actually adapted different models of care. So I think there were like VAs in California that had pharmacist-led treatment models.
That's definitely still happening.
Yeah, here. And a lot of task shifting that was actually implemented. Mm-hmm. And so like during 2015 to 2017, I think I read somewhere when we were kind of doing some research for that paper that Arpan and I wrote with the other colleagues, was that they were treating 2,000 veterans a week. Such that by like March of 2019, they had treated over 100,000, like close to 116,000 people living with Hep C. And the VA had a higher rate of Hep C infection in their patient population as well.
Awesome. So we've obviously talked about some solutions that have worked and then some solutions that have worked elsewhere and would definitely work here. And one of our big focuses for season two, which we've made it to, and thank you for being the first guest again, is health disparities. And unfortunately, Hep C is a great place to start that conversation. In America, for Black patients, they have higher rates of infection with HCV, lower rates of treatment with direct-acting antiretrovirals, even if you control for insurance and a variety of other factors, and have higher rates of HCV-related death. And so I'm curious, in terms of looking at the solutions we've seen here or anything else that you've sort of come across, are there particular strategies that you think would be most effective in narrowing these disparities for Black Americans when it comes to HCV care?
I think that health disparities with Hep C, as well as with many chronic diseases in general, have proximal roots in structural racism. This hasn't been acknowledged by health systems and health providers over the years. I also think that the disparities we're seeing, for example, with Hep C, are not as distal in terms of the roots as we may perceive them to be, for example, with screening and diagnosis. This isn't to pass the buck and say we can't do anything at the distal point of a given disease, like diagnosis and management. And in fact, we need to address them at the distal point, but we also need to acknowledge and address the proximal system level causes or roots to lead to better population outcomes. At the AASLD meeting last November, there were some really great talks on this topic. And one that in particular came to mind was one by Dr. Cynthia Gomez, where she discusses how health disparities are rooted in socio-ecological health inequities that really stem from oppression, corporate institution-level barriers, and environmental conditions. I think this is very true with chronic hepatitis C. At the same meeting, Dr. Lauren Nephew gave a really great talk about how representation matters and how minority communities are often underrepresented in clinical trials. It does beg us rethinking. I will say one thing I've learned, and this is more from like immigrant communities that I've spent a lot of time working with in New York City over the years, is that this concept of like, you know, culturally tailoring what we're doing for communities and patients is, I think, something that would be worthwhile looking into more. So in our, it was a Hep B outreach program largely that I was involved with in immigrant communities. And certainly the barriers there are very different because language proficiency, might be a different level of a barrier, type of barrier. But it kind of makes you think about like, how do we again rethink our models of care to reach the patients who need it or people living with diseases or at risk for them? So in these communities, like what worked really well was a culturally targeted patient navigator. So someone who looked like them, spoke the same languages as them, was embedded in the community, somebody who came from the community, helping them navigate that process. I think National Institutes of Minority Health Disparities have these great frameworks for how we can better try to understand and then implement better models of care. And they talk a lot about kind of individual or patient level barriers, community level barriers or factors, system level factors. And so I think we need to explore, is it engagement of support, community support? Is that an important thing to try to overcome barriers? Is it a health literacy issue? How is that different in different groups? So I don't think we have the answer, but I think best the resources, and by that I mean dollars, to like really help us rethink how we're going to deliver care and also make it accessible to people. And we haven't done that enough. We haven't done that enough. And I think that's the reflection we're seeing here.
Agreed. Well, thank you. But before we can let you go, we do need to do the now world famous, and we can say that because I think technically some of our listeners are in other countries, lightning round. So we just have a few questions for you. You can answer them as quickly or unquickly as you would like. Adam, you want to ask the first?
Yeah, sure. So the first one is, can you describe like a professional experience or something in which in your career in which luck has played a large role?
Yes. So I initially...
I was hoping your answer would be, I make my own luck.
Yeah, no. It took me a minute to... So I'll tell you a story. I don't know if you'll find it as interesting as I always think it is. So I was a third-year resident at George Washington. I knew I wanted to do GI as a fellowship because I initially really liked a combination of medicine, but really liked doing procedures. So that's kind of like how I initially started out in GI. But I knew GI applications were very competitive. I kind of wanted to take a break from training. So I applied in my third year. This was pre-match. For fellowship. And so I applied thinking I was going to take a year off after residency to maybe travel the world, maybe do some locum tenens, maybe work abroad. And so I didn't apply my second year, which is what most people do, even at that time. I applied in my third year, and one of the programs I applied to was NYU. And I got offered interviews at various places. And NYU called me up and said, hey, I know you applied for the spot in 2 years, like all the applicants, but we actually have a spot open for next year. Do you want to apply or interview for that position? And I said, sure, why not? I have a lot of good friends in New York. I'd gone there a lot during residency. And because of that, I ended up in New York. And I got accepted to a position to start immediately. And so I kind of like let go of my idea to take a year off. I have to say, I didn't look back. I thought I would look back and kind of, I wondered if I would regret it. I never regretted it. So the reason that happened was that someone had deferred their position kind of at the last minute. That person was a GI colleague, when you fast forward a few years later. And we did my first month of fellowship as a transplant hepatologist was with this colleague at Mount Sinai. So the whole reason I moved to New York was actually because of this one individual who deferred a year of fellowship. And that's how that spot opened up. And we became really good friends because he was a GI fellowship, a GI fellow at Mount Sinai. And I was starting my transplant fellowship.
Wow.
That's a great one.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think I feel so because like I ended up in New York for so long after that, for more than 15 years, and love New York.
Yeah, well, thank you for sharing that. So for a less profound question, depending on how you take it, what is your favorite liver cell?
I'm going to say the stellate cell because of my... I think a lot of that is embedded for me in us, the colleagues I worked with at Mount Sinai, who had, you know, a role with our understanding of stellate cells.
So. Shout out to Dr. Friedman, who we're still fairly certain doesn't listen to this podcast.
He might.
He may. We'll find out, I guess. Yeah.
Yeah. I'll ask him.
Love Dr. Friedman.
Yeah, he's great.
Yes.
All right. And the last one before we let you go is when's the last time you performed a colonoscopy?
Yesterday.
Oh, ah. There we go.
Nice.
See, hepatologists do colonoscopies too.
I work at the VA. And
that's right.
So what's, you know, so I do endoscopy. I'm doing a little bit more endoscopy now than I was previously.
Great.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much. Very enlightening.
Thank you.
Really appreciate you taking the time to come on. Thanks so much.
Thank you guys for having me. Really honored to be on this podcast and see you guys again.
Welcome back. We'd like to thank Dr. Puma Swamy again for a really fascinating interview. And now we're just going to spend the rest of the podcast discussing an article that we found interesting kind of surrounding this topic.
Yeah, so we are at least experimenting in season two with changing the freestyle segment, which we didn't receive any feedback on, which had to be negative. And there is a new Taylor Swift album since we recorded the last freestyle segment. But
I haven't listened to it, have you?
Yeah, it's pretty good. Okay. But what we thought we'd do is try to find something a little off the beaten path that relates to the topic that we were talking about, but that is a little more solution-oriented. And so we've talked a lot today about HCV and the fact that we now have the tool necessary to cure HCV, but we are a long way from eradication, and that the three sort of pillars of eradication are identification, linkage to care, and then actually being treated with DAAs. And so... Right. The paper that we found this time is titled An Innovative Approach to Increase Viral Hepatitis Diagnosis and Linkage to Care Using Opt-Out Testing in an Integrated Care Pathway in a London Emergency Department. So the title sort of says it all. So I guess we don't need to discuss anything here.
Except for the title of the journal, which I like to refer to as PLUS One.
Yeah. And so this was an ED-based intervention. It was a pilot study that was only done for 6 weeks in one London ED. So this is not some sort of massive study, but I think allows us to really dive into it and think a little bit more about the pros and cons and what we can take out of this. And what I think they liked about it being an emergency department and what really translates over to America as well is the idea that emergency rooms are a safety net. And while we have a far from perfect healthcare system, many people in many less well advocated for communities are potentially getting a lot of their care through the emergency department. So you can opportunistically screen and capture people that may be hard to screen and capture otherwise. And so any patient in this study that was 16 years or older, I imagine in the US it would be 18 years or older, went to the emergency room and had any blood tests drawn, it was automatic on the EMR that they would also have both a Hep B surface antigen and an HCV antibody checked unless they opted out of that. And they were told in very sort of normal terms that these things were going to be screened for at the time that their other tests were going to be screened for. And those that were positive, the idea was that they would be contacted by the emergency department and directly linked to care, and that they'd have an appointment with what they're describing as a viral hepatitis nurse specialist, where, you know, further follow-up testing would be done. And ideally, they would be set up with both a FibroScan and a right upper quadrant ultrasound during that initial appointment. So, you know, very concerted effort for linkage to care, and then a very expedited workup of either Hep B or Hep C or both. And so within the trial, a little over 3,200 patients were tested for Hep C. I'm focusing specifically on Hep C here, although they did do Hep B as well. Which was 56% of people that were offered the thing. So 44% opted out. They unfortunately didn't really have data on why those people opted out. And I think that would be interesting to delve into further in the future. Of the 3,200, 63 were HCV antibody positive, and then the reflux is a separate trial. But maybe we'll tackle that later this year. The reflux was not to RNA, which likely would have been the case here, but for cost-related reasons was to an HCV antigen. And so of the 63 that were antibody positive, 32 were antigen positive. Interestingly, at least within Hep C, the people that were most likely to be HCV positive were those in the trial that were described as having, quote, no fixed abode, also known as homeless, with an adjusted odds ratio of 18.9. And just to quickly tackle the linkage to care component, 32 patients had HCV antigen positivity. Of that, 18 were able to be contacted. And of those 18, 14 or 78% went to at least one appointment and were linked to care. And 10 were retained in care. I have a lot of thoughts about this paper. I'm sure you do as well. But I'll kick it to you for your sort of first thoughts.
Yeah, I mean, my thoughts are, I think it's just another way of kind of layering another sort of layer of cheesecloth over kind of the Swiss cheese that is trying to find patients on the margins who we need to find and test and treat. You know, it's certainly like a novel and sort of, I guess, somewhat progressive way of trying to find these patients, but it's obviously imperfect given the numbers that you stated. And it also kind of makes me think about, even in our practice now, the number of patients who have no abode or have no home, who's, you know, who are just so difficult to reach, even in a coordinated program like this, where you try to reach them, but maybe their phone number has changed or they're switching phones. And it's just, you know, I think it's like a really worthwhile initiative that sort of kind of tries to close up some of the holes through which patients are sliding. As you said, you know, an emergency department is, you know, a safety net to catch patients that we probably otherwise wouldn't see in our clinics. But even with these efforts, you know, we're still failing to connect with a sizable percentage of the patients that we're trying to reach.
Yeah, I mean, I completely agree. I think that, first of all, what potentially the power of the study is, or if you were to think about how you could even improve further on it, I'm generally obsessed with the idea of opt-out interventions, with the classic example being organ donation.
Yes.
But here, when you have an opt-out, granted, almost 50% of people did opt out, but you were able to find 32 people with Hep C. As the paper alludes to, not all 32 of those were sort of new Hep C diagnoses, but even there, it was a 1% prevalence, basically. So 3,200 people tested with 32 that were HCV antigen positive. And so you could imagine a scenario within sort of the same network where you would have one-time opt-out HCV and HBV testing, where if you were seen in a specialty clinic, a primary care clinic, the emergency department, anywhere else that you may be, that it would automatically flag that this is going to be tested for, unless you've already been tested for it before, would go I think, a very long way in terms of at least tackling that first pillar of HCV eradication. I completely agree that where this falls woefully short is in the linkage to care. I think the idea of the linkage to care is good, but there's a reason why it's difficult. And coming up with more innovative approaches to, once you've diagnosed someone, getting them in to see someone, I think is, you know, obviously crucial. But I don't want to poo-poo the whole study because of that, and do think that this idea of opt-out testing for things that are data-driven to be tested for and that you can do something about, such as hepatitis C, could be a real game changer in starting us on a more sustainable pathway to eradication.
Yeah. The other thing that comes to mind too is with an opt-out rate almost 50%, yeah. I think that speaks, at least in my mind, to maybe a messaging issue. Mm-hmm. And so trying to synthesize the messaging so that it becomes more of a appealing option to, I guess, not opt out for these things, just makes me think that, and I have no idea if this is true, so this is like pure speculation on my part, but it just makes me think that maybe the messaging that we're doing around this kind of testing needs to be improved, simplified, or, you know, some needs to be improved in some way to get those numbers up a little bit.
Yeah. I completely agree. I think 44% opt-out is very high. And if you were to pitch it as something like, we want to test for an infectious disease that is curable now, but first we need to know that you have it before we can treat it, I would imagine a lot of people would potentially opt in for one-time lifetime testing.
Yeah, it's just strange, especially because the intervention is something that's already that's not an additional, you know, blood draw. It's something that has already been done. So it raises some questions in my head, but
I agree.
But still, interesting stuff.
Agreed. Well, I think that's it. Please let us know your thoughts as well, either on Twitter or in your review. If you want us to go back to the freestyle segment, you will not need to twist our arms very hard.
Yeah, please.
but we thought we'd try something new. And thank you all for listening, as always. If you haven't already, please subscribe. And we will be back at the beginning of March with episode 2 of season 2.
Or maybe season 3, episode 1.
That's true. That's true. Exactly. Well, with that, bye, Adam.
Bye, Alex.
And last but not least, I should just make a plug. Today, while we're recording, it's not the day it's going to be launching, but it is my sister's birthday. So happy birthday, Becky.
Happy birthday, Becky.
One of our most loyal listeners.